Hello, friends, and welcome to the Caroline Gleick podcast. I'm Caroline Gleick. I'm your host. On this show, we're going to be exploring a variety of topics from adventure and activism, climate change messaging, mountaineering, skiing, relationships, and how we can use sports to change the world. We're going to have some exciting experts coming up, but today, to start, we're going to be answering your questions from Instagram about coronavirus with two experts, epidemiologists from the University of Utah. Thanks for being here. Before we get started, here's a quick message. Tell me when you're ready.
I'm good.
Okay. Me too.
So today it is March 17th, and I'm here with Lindsay Keegan and Angela Presson to answer some questions about coronavirus that we have on Instagram. And so keep in mind that this is rapidly changing, but I'll hand it over to our scientists here and let them do an introduction.
So, hey everybody, I'm Lindsay Keegan. I'm a research assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Utah. And my research primarily focuses on understanding this transmission and control of infectious diseases. And so as such, as the coronavirus swept through, I've sort of dropped all of my normal threads, and I've been working like 24/7 on understanding coronavirus transmission and how to control it.
I'm Angela Presson, and I'm in Lindsay's department or division. I'm an research associate professor, and I'm a statistician, but I'm definitely interested in keeping up with the latest literature and trying to help people get a better understanding of what it is and what it isn't, and so happy to help.
Okay, well, people have a lot of questions, and so I did a quick Instagram poll where people sent in their questions, and so I thought we could run through a couple of those. So the first question is, can you show symptoms and not have a fever?
Yeah, so I don't have the chart in front of me, but it's something like 88% of cases have a cough, and it's a little bit lower in fever. Let me see if I can pull that up really quickly. It is, 87.9% from the WHO study, and 74.3% of people have fever, from a different study in China. So, not 100% of people, but, definitely a high proportion.
Okay. Can people that don't have a fever or any symptoms, they can still be positive, right?
Yes, absolutely. So that's one of the problems, especially in children and young people, is that there's a much higher rate of asymptomatic cases. So there's a figure going around on Twitter, and I don't think it's published yet, so take it with a grain of salt, but it shows that there's really a high rate of asymptomatic infections. So that means that you are infected with the disease, you are able to transmit it to other people, but you don't show any symptoms at all. And so that's highest in young people. So this is the big reason why we're telling people to social distance, to stay away from people. You could be infected and you could pass it on to people who are at high risk of dying. So either because they're old or because they're immunocompromised. So you could be not infected and then, you could be not showing symptoms, infected, and then pass it on to somebody who then dies from it, which is the big concern.
Right. Okay, another question I got is, they said it kills a lot of diabetic patients. What type of diabetic patients, type 1 or 2?
Unfortunately, I don't think we have any detail on that. Like, the comorbidities, so these are other diseases that are associated with negative outcomes in from coronavirus, are really, like, broad. So we have one category for diabetes and one category for, like, all lung problems. So we don't have, like, we just don't have the data. We don't have, it's too early in the epidemic. Unfortunately, like, people are scrambling as best they can, and we're getting this out. So, you know, maybe in the next week or two, we'll have a better understanding. But unfortunately, right now, just act as if you have any type of diabetes, you're at risk. So that's all I got for you.
Okay, a lot of unknowns. It's understandable. Okay, so once infected, how long is the course of the disease in a person?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So generally from the time to exposure, from exposure to symptom onset, it's about 4 to 5 days, but that ranges from 2 to 14. So there's a really broad range. And so this is just from exposure to when you become symptomatic. And then once you become symptomatic, there's a whole broad host of things that can happen. So you could have a relatively mild infection. And when we say a mild infection, we mean severe flu and potentially pneumonia, but non-hospitalized. So that's the cutoff for severe. So anything that's considered mild means you were in the hospital. Anything severe or critical means you were in the hospital. So that's sort of our definition. And then that averages about 11 days, whether you recover or die. But if you recover and you're hospitalized, on average, or the range for how long you're in the hospital is anywhere from only a couple of days to, I think the longest was 81 days. So this can lead to some really serious hospitalizations, and that's among people who survive. People who die tend to die faster.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really sobering. Okay, so.
I mean, I think the other thing that, you know, is important to think about as a young, healthy person, you know, could you afford a stay in the hospital for 81 days? Like, this is something that I have been thinking about a lot. It's like, how are we gonna grapple with the downstream effects of this? So, I mean, when you think like, oh, I'll just go climbing, I'll just go skiing, I'm a healthy young person, I'll survive, like, yeah, but if you're in the hospital in the ICU, it's not gonna be good.
That's crazy. Yeah. That is so crazy. Okay, so how long will all these closures be?
I don't know. That's the short answer. The long answer is the better we are at social distancing, the longer it will take. And that's because of the flattening the curve. So I think by this point, everybody has heard flatten the curve, but maybe doesn't know what the curve is and why we're flattening it. So the curve that we're talking about is the epidemic curve. So it's the number of people infected each day. And so for a typical disease, you see an exponential growth, and then it reaches its peak, and then it's an exponential decline. So you get this nice little bell-shaped curve of infections. And the problem with that is when you have a pandemic, health systems are not built to withstand like massive surges in the number of people who come in to the hospital. And so we want to flatten that curve, but we don't actually change the total number of infections very much. There is a slightly smaller number of total number of people who get infected when we do flatten the curve. But what we end up doing is we make it so everybody doesn't get infected all at once. So if you do need to go into the hospital, there's an ICU bed for you. There's a doctor who can take care of you. There's personal protective equipment so that doctor doesn't get infected or infect other people. So that's why we need to flatten that curve. And so if we do that, then the epidemic is going to take a longer course than if we let it all burn through the population really fast and all of us end up in the ICU and there aren't any ICU beds and we end up like Italy. So it's kind of like a trade-off.
Lindsay, isn't it also the case that we are expecting that, you know, if this virus behaves like other viruses, like flu viruses, that it could potentially die out as the summer starts and then potentially kind of start up again next flu season?
So that's something that everyone talks about. And one of the things about that is pandemics don't tend to follow that same pattern. So one thing we do worry about is that everyone will be really great at social distancing. The disease will come down in numbers and die out. People will stop social distancing and go back into the population, and then we'll see a second wave from that. But it'll be less from temperature and humidity factors and more from mixing of the population. So that is a concern as a second wave. And I mean, I think at this point, it's not breaking news to say we believe that this virus is probably here to stay. It's probably going to become part of the normal seasonal viruses, but a benefit of viruses being around for a long time is that they generally tend to mutate to be less virulent, so less severe. So if you get this down the road in the course, you're gonna have a probably, if we can judge from other epidemics, you're gonna have a less severe virus than you did if you were like case number one, case number two, where it first jumped into the human host. Because the virus's ultimate goal, like if you could talk about it like it had a goal, is to spread. And if it kills everybody, it doesn't spread. So it ends up like you have these interesting like evolutionary trade-offs where the virus eventually mutates to be less and less severe. But that's like down the road. That's not in the next 6 months.
So. Crazy. Fascinating. Okay, so when will we have a rapid test and why aren't we testing more people?
We're not testing more people because we don't have the testing capacity. So unfortunately, the FDA didn't approve the World Health Organization test, so the CDC had to build up their own test. We do see some research tests, like the one in Seattle, being approved to become clinical tests. So we have clinical tests and research tests. Research tests can be used for studies, and they don't have the same stringent standards of test sensitivity and specificity. So false positives, false negatives. So clinical tests have to go through FDA approval to show that they have the, that they're accurate, essentially, that they're precise and that they're accurate. And so there are rapid ways to get through that, and we're starting to see some of those now. So AREP, the lab here in Salt Lake, is now scaling up their testing ability, and they will probably be one of the major testers for the United States, which is great. Seattle has a test, and the federal government is working as quickly as they can, I believe, to rapidly approve more tests.
Cool. Thanks for that. What should immunocompromised people be doing differently?
I mean, you should take this very seriously, and hopefully you can convince the people that you interact with on a daily basis to take it seriously. As things start to get more scary, I think, and more cases, I think one of the things we need to remember that is that we're a community here. I mean, not just Salt Lake, but the broader ski community. And you should reach out to your neighbors and your friends who might be older or immunocompromised and maybe do their grocery shopping for them, or, you know, drop off some food. And you don't have to go into their house. You should wash your hands before and after, and like you can drop food off on their porch for them. But we should be checking in on our neighbors and making sure that people are helping each other out, because, you know, you do, like, the ultimate goal is to just avoid contacting sick people.
That's great advice. I mean, I think that's something that a lot of young, healthy people can do. And I think, especially in our neighborhoods, like, I'm trying to think maybe next door app or something, because I don't necessarily want to go door to door knocking on people's, to yeah. Like, are you elderly? Do you need help?
My neighbors are a lot closer. Like, I see, they sit on their porch every night, and I joke that we watch the dog parade because everybody walks their dog by the house. So I know the neighbors on either side. So like,
I'm up in Park City, and we're quite a ways from our neighbors. So it would be quite a trek for me to go door to door, but maybe the next door app, or like, there's a cool Facebook group set up. I'm just worried that older people aren't on social, like the real people who need help may not be on social media, but.
Well, maybe like reach out to grandma, and then she has some friends who you could help out to, or something like that, so.
Grandma's on lockdown now at the assisted living, so.
maybe not, but.
The women there, or the caretakers, who are mostly women, which is why I said the women there, could help us do FaceTime with her.
Oh, great, yeah.
I'm hoping.
And I've seen some cute things where people go and they stand outside of assisted living and then they call. So that's cute. That.
It's so cute. She's on the second floor, but
maybe. Oh, yeah.
I was already.
Get a ladder.
Maybe we can get on the first floor, though, through a window somewhere, but.
You like climbing, right? Just like scale.
Yeah, but it's a little, I mean, we're not supposed to do the risky stuff right now.
Oh, true. We are supposed to minimize our risk and avoid things that are going to put us in the ICU. First of all, because hospitals are going to be overwhelmed. And second of all, like, do you really want to be in an ICU where everyone around you potentially has coronavirus? Like, that's really not a great place to be. So.
Totally. I know. it's a really, it's something I didn't really think about until I saw someone's tweet. I think it was someone out of Italy, and they're like, yeah, sure, you can go skiing, but if you fall and break your leg, will there be a bed? I don't know. Will there be a doctor? Probably not. So it really made me think about risk and bouldering, you know, climbing up.
Yeah.
That's not something I'm very proficient in.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah.
The thing I was telling people in my messaging is, it's like, if you're a very experienced, proficient backcountry skier, then maybe it's okay to go skiing right now. As long as you can, like, pick an objective that's well within your ability range. But if you're, like, normally used to skiing at the resort, you've never skied in the backcountry, and we're about to get a powder storm, like, it's probably not the time to pick up backcountry skiing. So,
and along that line, you don't really want to, you know, like, yeah, we're going to have great powder, but, like, maybe it's a Grizzly Gulch day where you're not going to cause an avalanche and then have to be rescued and put all those people rescuing at risk.
Right. Totally. Yeah, those are really important things to think about. And I was going to go back to that, because one of the questions that we talked about before we started recording was the person who asked if it's cool, is going on a yurt trip a bad idea? And you said it depends on who you're going with, where you're going.
Okay, first thing, don't get on an airplane. Like, all of you who are listening, unless there is some emergency that, like, you absolutely have to be on an airplane for, do not get on an airplane. You're putting yourself at risk. You're putting the flight crew at risk. You're putting everybody else in the airport at risk. Do not get on an airplane. Like, I'm not the first person to say that. Like, I'm the 100th person at this point. Avoid that. If you have to travel, travel by car. That's, like, the best. I mean, you know where the inside of your car has been. You're interacting with way fewer people. Like, you know, wipe down the gas pump with a Lysol wipe or something, and wash your hands more frequently.
Yeah, I had a quick question actually about Gore-Tex gloves.
Yeah, what about
them? If I'm wearing my Gore-Tex gloves, my ski gloves, then is that a barrier, or does that just stay on the fabric surface?
When you wear your ski gloves, do you touch your face with your ski gloves?
Yeah, I do. I wipe my nose.
There you go. So it's just as bad. So if you take your ski gloves off and then wipe your nose and then put your hand back in your ski glove, you're protecting yourself. But that's the thing, is, like, you cover yourself skiing, but then you reach under the covering.
Totally. Because all these people, like, were so disappointed when the ski resorts closed, understandably. But yeah.
I mean, think about the people who work inside the ski resort who are at risk. That's who, like, if it was just the hill, it's not as big of a risk as the fact that, like, we're going to the bar, we're paying at the lift lines, there's all the lifties, like.
And people also traveling from all over the world to go to the ski resorts. I mean, to me, that's kind of the biggest issue. I mean, a lot of cases in Colorado developed because somebody from Italy came over to ski. The mountain towns don't have the capacity to kind of handle their COVID just, cases, so.
Mountain towns are just cesspools.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so in a third of the cases in Utah right now are from people out of town, so, like, that puts it into perspective.
I just noticed, like, when I was on a tour with my friends the other day, I was like, maintain social distance.
Yeah.
So bad at it. I'm like, 6 feet, guys. Like, how many times do I have to tell everybody? Like,
well, the good thing about skiing is, like, when you're wearing skis and they're wearing skis, even if your skis are kind of, like, close, you're still pretty close to 6 feet apart if you're all on a line.
Yeah.
Like, if you're in a skin track, but if you're sort of all going up, like, a cat track, like, maybe not.
It's very unnatural for us, I think. And especially people that are, like, warm and, like, lovely people, they're like muggers, they want to be close, and I'm like, no.
Yeah,
who is, like, the enforcer. So
back to the yurt trip, so if you're gonna drive there, that's fine. If you're gonna stay in a yurt with you and your family, the people who would be isolated in your home with you, like, go for it. Like, if you don't have to interact with a bunch of other people. Now, if you're talking about flying somewhere and going to a yurt with 20 other people, like, don't do that. Like, don't be stupid. So,
but I guess, like, my impulse would be, like, to tell people no, because, like, people just right now are still, I don't think, taking it as seriously.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think it's a balance, because if you tell people to be too overly stringent, they're not going to follow it. Like, the ideal situation is that nobody comes into contact with anybody else for a couple of weeks, and then we let this whole thing burn out.
Yeah.
But, like, it's not reasonable to say, nobody come into contact with another human for, like, weeks while we let this disease burn out. So we just got to do the best we can. And if that means like going on a ski tour with two people instead of six people, like that's a good compromise.
Yeah. Okay.
It that means like do the backcountry, like, you know, like do your long off, don't go to the popular trailheads, go to the ones that like maybe are a Stairmaster to get up to or don't have quite as beautiful of a view.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point for sure.
My favorite is always to go at night. Like I love Mill Creek Road at night because I'm the only one ever there. So don't come follow me.
Well, Mill Creek Road is really mellow. Like I would feel really scared to tell people to go at night because I just feel like they can get more injured skiing at night.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. I wouldn't go on like a big tour, but like a nice little casual hike or like a Mill Creek Road kind of situation at night where I do it all the time.
Yeah.
No one around. So.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's don't okay do anything that's going to get you hurt.
It's okay to pass by people too. Like it's not, you know, you don't have to maintain 6 feet while walking past someone necessarily. I think they say that it's social distancing is more important for the extended periods of time.
It's also important for the straight in front of you. So like as you're spewing viral particles out of your mouth as you're talking and coughing, it's gross, I'm sorry, it goes sort of in a straight line. Like there's not a lot of like peripheral spew.
That's good to know.
Yeah, so being directly in front of somebody is worse than being to the side. I mean, there's still some, like you're not in the clear, but it's much worse in this path right here than it is like out here.
Got it. Okay, so I heard like if you're in close contact with someone for 15 minutes, then there's like a high likelihood that you'll get it.
So remember, the definition of the two cases is if you take an average infected individual, put them in a totally susceptible population, and let them intermix, they'll only infect two people, which sounds small. But seasonal flu is less than that. Seasonal flu is like 1.3 people. And yet we still have it every year. So it is doubling, like cases are doubling. But from that, like they've done studies of household transmission and from early Chinese data, only 15% of household members got it. So you're not doomed, you know.
Okay, that's way better than I thought. I was like, yeah, we were doing this like video shoot the other day with these two guys, and I'm like, the only way we're gonna do it is if we maintain social distancing and in my husband's office, and they were all in there, and I was like, if one of you guys has it, you all have it now.
I mean, there are, so this disease especially has a lot of super spreaders. So that means people who cause way more than average. So, like we saw the initial case in New York City, in New Rochelle, I think caused something like 34 secondary infections. So that means one person caused 34 infections. So like the average doesn't necessarily mean, it's not the only information there is. There's a lot of variation. So some people will infect zero people and some people like that person will infect 34 people. So.
Okay. I feel like if I got it, I would have, if I had kept traveling, I would be like one of those, they'd be like, whoa, Utah woman linked to like cases.
Yeah, pro skier linked to coronavirus outbreak.
Bad PR. So I'm really glad that like one of my sponsors, Patagonia, like they had suspended all non-essential employee travel. Like they did that 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with the outdoor industry. For the most part, like companies are taking this seriously and taking the lives of their consumers and their employees really, like they value them, so.
Yeah, it's been cool. Okay, do you wanna do one or two more?
Yeah, it sounds good. I hope this is helpful for everyone, so.
I think it's gonna be great. I think people are gonna love it.
Okay, good. Okay,
is it safe to send receive mail?
There's always the possibility that your UPS carrier coughs on it. So maybe if like this gets really bad and you're really worried and maybe you're really immunocompromised, you leave your mail in a pile for 24 hours because it doesn't live on paper for much longer than that. But I think that's sort of extreme. What was that?
24 hours?
Yeah, so it lives on cardboard in lab settings for, I think I sent you a paper earlier today about that.
Yeah.
for 24 hours. So, I mean, that's sort of like a really extreme, like I'm still getting my mail. The one thing you do have to think about when you send mail is like, there are people who are moving the mail, so like they have to go to work. But, you know, what, like we can't grind our entire lives to a complete halt, which is why we can't stop this completely.
Yeah. I think we could do something similar with groceries. If you're immunocompromised or elderly, you could potentially leave the groceries at the door in their bags and let them sit for like 2 to 3 days. I think they can potentially live on plastic for longer.
So maybe if you're picking up groceries for your elderly neighbor, get a paper bag instead of your normal reusable. Yeah. Canvas bags are actually supposed to be better than the normal reusable bags, which are made of plastic. So bring your neighbors their groceries in canvas bags or paper bags. I have no science to back that up. I just don't. That's what the internet tells me.
Wait, I have a question. Like, if you're, so that's, but need to be refrigerated or frozen. Do you have any data on how long it lives on surfaces? Or
I mean, if you refrigerate a virus, that's like how we keep them for long times. How do we store them in laboratories? So it'll be like, yeah,
if you get your groceries, you take them home and you freeze or refrigerate them, it could be on there forever. So wash your hands before you eat and cook the food.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, there's like, you're never gonna get yourself down to zero risk. Like, once you have an epidemic in the population, you're not gonna get down to zero risk. What you wanna do is you wanna minimize your risk, and especially if you're elderly. So, you know, not going to the grocery store is already gonna be a huge benefit. I mean, what you could do, like, if you're delivering groceries, you could wipe down their groceries if they're boxes or something. Like, you know, if it's in a container, you can wipe it down with a Lysol wipe. You wipe it down with soap and water. Soap and water is a great way to kill this virus, because this virus has a viral envelope, and soap actually breaks apart that viral envelope. So wash your hands with soap. Sing the alphabet song in your head, or I guess out loud, or happy birthday twice while you're washing your hands. That's how long you got to do it for.
Yeah.
So.
That's fascinating. Okay. If I have to fly domestically in the next week, is it smarter to do that now or wait a week?
You can't drive. You have to fly.
Yeah.
I would say that things are only going to be worse in the next week. So we're not near the peak yet. So I would get it done. I would be extra cautious that you're not putting other people at risk. I would wash your hands a lot. I would, you know, maybe not eat on the airplane. You could be more cautious if you're immunocompromised and wipe down the plane seat with a Lysol wipe. Like, you know, try. I think there's so few people on airplanes right now that you get like a whole section of the airplane to yourself. So that's good. Don't travel if you're sick. But yeah.
Yeah, one of my best friends, her mom had a pancreatic cancer diagnosis, and she lives in California and her mom lives on the East Coast, and she had to fly. And I was like, oh my gosh, out of all the times in the world, I like my heart just goes out to people that have to travel for something like that, because her mom is in a really bad place. So
absolutely. And like funerals happen and things like that. There are emergencies that you have to travel for, and you should just try to minimize that. Try to let the people who absolutely have to be on planes, and let's, you know, maybe everybody else stay away.
Yeah. So I guess one other question, how do we tell when our country is at the peak?
When it starts coming down.
Yeah, that's a really hard
epidemic curve.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a lot of stochasticity, and the thing is, so there's a lot of randomness. And the thing is that each city isn't going to hit the peak at the same time, because we didn't all start at the same time. So, you know, in Utah, we're a little ways behind Seattle. We're a little ways behind New York and California. And so we can look to them and know, sort of what's coming. Like right now, if you want to know what's coming in Utah, look to Seattle, New York, Italy, and California. Like that's what's coming to Utah if we don't get our stuff together. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
I have a great website that shows the the real-time data for the U.S. and it has, it shows the epidemic curve that Lindsay's been talking about. So you'll be able to check back and see when that curve is flattening out, essentially.
Oh, great. That's awesome. Well, I could put that in the Instagram stories when I post
it. Yeah, I'll send it to you.
I'm taking notes. And so I'll edit my notes and then send them to you. Okay, I just had one more question that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
And that is, 1 second, let me find it. And you've kind of talked about long-term effects.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you get this virus, short-term, many people get pneumonia, short-term. And that is going to put you on your back for a while. Like, if you get pneumonia, your summer sports season is not going to be, like, your lungs are going to be recovering. You're going to have lost muscle mass from lying in bed for so long. Like, you're just not going to have a fun summer season. Like, it's not something that you're just going to, like, bounce back from the next day when your fever goes away, for the most part. I mean, like, there will be people who get really mild infections, and it won't be. But for the most part, what we know from SARS, and so this is not this disease, but this is the one that was spreading in China in 2003, 2004, is that there's evidence of long-term lung damage, potentially even permanent lung damage from the pneumonia that you get associated with SARS. People have described it as like a respiratory virus crossed with like HIV, because it has such severe impacts on your immune system. And I don't purport to be an expert on this, but what we can gather from early data on this disease is that it has similar short-term effects as SARS. And so we guess from our best understanding that it would probably have similar long-term effects. And so in that regard, it's not something to take lightly. But at the same time, like, we don't know. Like, it might be that in a year, people's lungs recover perfectly, or it might be that people follow exactly like SARS. That's one of the problems with dealing with emerging infectious diseases, is just we don't know. And so as things progress, we start to learn more. But early on, you can only go based on similar diseases. And so that's what we have. So.
Crazy. Hey, I have a personal question. Two personal questions, then we'll be done. I'm supposed to have a meeting with my orthopedic surgeon on Thursday.
Are you sure?
Should I go?
Are you sure you still have it?
Yeah.
As of today, yes.
Okay. And it's not telemedicine?
No.
Are you at a separate ortho clinic? Because a lot of times ortho clinics are separate from hospitals.
It's at the Park City Hospital.
It's not, or it is?
It is, but it's in a different part than the emergency care.
But it's I would defer that to your doctor. Like, if they think it's safe and they have the time to see you, then yeah. But from, you know, as this goes on, more and more, like, routine visits are going to be telemedicine
right, or
delayed. So yeah, if they think it's good, if they think they're good to see you, then
you okay.
Oh, yeah. Your doctor is the expert on you. So,
I mean, part of the thing is I've just had a lot of swelling, so they might do an injection.
Oh yeah.
Is there any risk of getting like a cortisone inject? I mean, I've like, my knees had this swelling, like, cause I heard that prednisone and ibuprofen and stuff weakens your immune system with this. So is there any like caution for that right now?
I'm going to have to refer you to your doctor, cause I'm a PhD, mm-hmm. not an MD. So I don't really feel great giving any medical advice, but doctor knows.
Yeah. Well, in the same with the dentist, if people have dentist appointments.
Yeah. So I actually someone brought this up to me today that dentist appointments might be getting canceled, because if you think about it, like, the dentist is at really high risk in your mouth, in your face, like them getting infected from you, you getting infected from them. So again, like, I would follow your dentist, their individual recommendations, like they will know what's best for them and their practice. But yeah, it's definitely, like, things are going to change with medicine in the next couple of months as we, like, yeah, there's talk of bringing in, like, fourth-year med students to help with some of this. There's talk of asking retired doctors to come back and help with some of this as we get to surge capacity. So just to, like, deal with just the volume of cases. And so, like, if we look to the Netherlands and to Italy, they're reassigning doctors from other specialties to work in emergency care. So, yeah, patient with your doctors if things get canceled. I know it's frustrating. I know the U has already canceled elective surgeries. So I think a lot of people have been waiting for surgeries for a really long time, and that's super frustrating. But yeah, remember, it's both for your own benefit. Like, you don't want to be recovering from a surgery in a hospital full of people mm-hmm. who have coronavirus, and it's for the benefit of the doctors. Like, they need to reallocate their time to handle these emergent cases. So, yeah.
Okay, so then in terms of, like, me as an athlete, like, expedition planning, like, do we think, like, June is going to be a good time to go on an expedition, or are we thinking, like, December?
Next June.
And, like, what's it, not June?
Next June.
Next June? I know.
Maybe sooner.
Antarctica in December of 2020.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't tell you right now. It, like, it all depends on how we handle this. Like, yeah, like, so much is going to change in the next couple months. And, you know, maybe check back in June and we'll talk, but definitely not this year. Like, all of your major, not this June, that's what I mean. Like, all of your major trips for, like, this summer, you should plan closer to home versions that don't, plus it's good for the environment, right? Think of it that way.
Yeah, yeah, totally. No,
but
I'm with you. I just, like, we are talking about, well, also I think the economy is going to take a big hit. So
it's
going to be a lot harder to get sponsor funding to go on, like, the big international trip.
Yeah. So, but I mean, December, maybe.
But, like, it might go to Southern Hemisphere, right? Because do you think that's going to happen?
I mean, it's already in Australia right now. Like, it doesn't seem to be following the same seasonal patterns right now because everyone is susceptible. So it's just, like, spreading.
Right.
And so as we, like, it's going to burn through the global population of susceptibles. And how fast it does that depends on social distancing. It depends on if all the epidemics start at once, or if, like, you know, we have a bunch of little epidemics and then they move. So it's gonna, like, we can check back in June for what's gonna happen in December, maybe.
Okay, but, that sounds good. Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything else we want to do to wrap this up?
I think my main takeaway point that I really want everyone to, like, walk away from this with is just, this is a serious public health threat. And even if your personal risk isn't particularly high, the risk to people you know and care about is, like, grandma, your neighbor, your friend who's immunocompromised, somebody who has cancer. Like, we all know people who are immunocompromised and who are older, and their lives are at risk. So act like their lives are at risk. You know, like, you might walk out of this totally fine. Like, you're healthy, you're young, you might get a bad flu with pneumonia, you know, you recover for 6 weeks, and then it's like it never happened to you, right? Like, that could be totally, like, you could be just, like, back to skiing in, like, 6 weeks or whatever, just like you were, you know, yesterday. Or you could kill your grandma, you know, like, there's, so, like, that's the thing. I just, like, people, it's hard to evaluate your own personal risk, and it's hard to evaluate, like, these pandemic situations because they're so rare. And Angela can probably talk about, like, understanding rare statistics, but, you know, you just got to remember that, like, people are dying from this and people will die from this. And, you know, if we all act according to social distancing and we all, you know, try to have some compassion for our neighbors, then we can kill much fewer people than they're projecting right now. Like, the goal is to make the models wrong, right? The models are projecting worst case scenario right now. Like, let's make the models wrong.
I like that.
Yeah, and I'll just add, like, one point that I'd like to make, that I hear from a lot of friends, like, oh, well, you know, the flu kills, like, 12,000 to 60,000 people a year, and we're, you know, we've only killed, like, 100 people right now, or COVID's only killed 100 people, and so it's, you know, it's nothing compared to the flu. And I just want to say, like, I think that that's true. Like, maybe overall this virus,
well, the mortality rate, I'm going to correct you, the mortality rate is 10 to 20 times higher than the flu.
No, I do. Well, I heard 6 to 10, but yeah, okay. I mean, it's certainly higher, but the thing is that that depends, you know, that's assuming a lot of those models are assuming that we don't do anything about the virus, right? And we're going to take a lot of measures. So I think that those worst case scenarios are probably quite extreme.
Well, so right now the estimates of mortality are based on China. So China and Italy. So yeah. if you look to those, that's like the actual number of people who died. It's between 10 to 20 times higher. Italy is worse because their health system was overwhelmed, and you can read stories about it, but basically like their ICU was so overrun that people are dying because they just can't get medical care because they just don't have enough. So right. that's like a higher end of things. But in China,
I don't know. I don't know what the numbers will be, but like, when talking with Matt, he said maybe thousands, maybe tens of thousands, which would put it at like comparable to the flu. But the point I want to make is something we have already talked about, but the healthcare systems are really at risk of getting overrun. And that's not something that happens with the regular flu, because if the cases are more spread out, and I believe there's fewer pneumonia cases. And so the real risk is that the health systems can get overrun. And then if we're in that situation, we might have to turn people away from medical care. So, situations where we might be able to save people's lives, but instead we're having to turn them away. And so I feel like that's going to be a really traumatic situation if we do get in that situation. I mean, hopefully we can avoid it, but to me, that's kind of one of the major risks that that people need to know. And I think also Lindsay mentioned, it did come up that that as a result, like other people that are in need of the ICU may not be able to access the ICU. So that would also augment the death toll as well, if other traumas or diseases are not, being able to be treated because the hospital beds are full. So it's the real threat.
Yeah. If we don't act, like, you can read in the news the stories that are coming out of Italy. I don't need to say them here, but they're terrifying in some cases. And like, we don't want to get to the point where we're running out of equipment and the doctors are getting sick because there's not enough personal protective equipment for them. And, people are dying in the hospital because there's not enough ventilators to save people and things like that. So, that's like a big risk that's the whole flatten the curve thing that everyone's talking about. Yeah.
I know. I mean, the choices that those doctors have to make must be horrible. My heart goes out to them, because just thinking through those scenarios, it's like, I feel like, yeah, it's just kind of crazy. My dad's 88 and he's like, I'm going to be the one that they take off the ventilator. And I'm like, well, I don't have kids. They'd probably save the woman who has kids over the one without kids. But like, being in that position would just be so horrible. Like, I can't even imagine. And so my heart really goes out to those people that have already been through that or are going through that now. And it's really, that's a really strong take-home message to get people to take this seriously.
Yeah. And I have a friend who's a ICU doctor in the Netherlands right now. And he's telling me that they're already like at full capacity. So they're a little bit ahead of us, not quite to Italy, and they're already at full capacity. They're not having to make these like life or death decisions yet, but he's not allowed to leave the hospital anymore. He's just working there like constantly. Like, he sleeps at the hospital now. So it's not, it's not a great situation. So
yeah.
Thankfully he doesn't have kids or a spouse. So it's a little easier, I guess. But, there was a person on the daily this morning. They had interviewed an Italian doctor, and he went home for the first time to see his kids in 3 weeks. So
crazy. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for everything you're doing and for taking the time.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Thanks for getting this out to your followers. It's like a very broad base that hopefully, we can make some difference in flattening the curve through your followers.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, cool. Well, I will be in touch. We'll be in touch soon.
Great. And let me know if you guys have any more questions that come in through your Instagram.
Cool. I'm sure there'll be a lot more. So
yeah, I'm sure after we're talking.
I know. I'll just wait until we're done. I'll send you all of them.
And perfect.
If you want to type up some more answers, then we can add them that way too. So.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay, awesome.
All right, it was great talking with you.
Mm-hmm. Have a good one.
Social distancing is over. You'll have to come visit us at the U. So.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Okay. All right. Later. Bye.
Bye.